As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I am here to welcome Alex Stewart.
Hi.
I got that all wrong, didn't I? I've done that 1,000 times.
Convoluted, but we got
there
eventually.
I am welcomed by Alex Stewart. Now, Alex and I have got a lot to talk about this week because, of course, the Champions League happened. PSG, Manchester City, Real Madrid, Chelsea. We talk about those games. We talk about Christina Aguilera. We talk about The Sopranos and some other stuff that pops up too. There's a Joe's Player Quotes and Facts database at the end, which was very exciting. Seb isn't here this week. He's on a holiday, a well-earned rest, although he keeps tweeting about football, so I don't know how much of a switch-off he's actually getting.
Yeah, I noticed that as well, yeah.
What a bastard. Yeah, but he'll be back next week, so that'll be fun for us. But what did you enjoy about today's episode, Alex?
Just all of it, Joe. It was just a roller coaster of fun.
Uh-huh. What a hollow answer. It really was a...
I did the. I was flabbergasted by the Tony Soprano information. That genuinely shocked me.
There's some age-related Soprano information that we discuss at some point in this podcast. Stick around for that. Also, if you like finding out what age people are, you should subscribe to The Athletic.
Ages. Where sometimes they'll put a footballer and then his age in a bracket after his name.
No, it's normally after a comma. That's the common way of doing it. But, you know, that's one of the places where you can find out. Plus other things like everything that's happening and all the top info out there you can get, mainly from the mouth of people such as David Ornstein, Ollie Kay, Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence. Yeah, I could carry on for quite a long time, actually. There's a big staff here at The Athletic UK. And I'm delighted to be able to offer you a 30-day free trial. So you can actually just try it out for free. How about that? You don't even need to part with any of your hard-earned money. So if you visit theathletic.com/TIFO, that's theathletic.com/TIFO, you can get a 30-day free trial now and enjoy it for the next 29 days and then cancel. Woo! But you'll find out about loads of people's ages during that time. All right, well, that's all. We'll crack on with the episode now, starting with PSG and Man City, and I will leave you, of course, in the warm hands and the very cool embrace of Dr. Alex Stewart. Okay. Beginning with PSG 1-2 Manchester City, it was a game of two halves, Alex. There were two halves in this game. Half one, PSG were excellent. Neymar, tantalising. He deserved that lovely goal. Although, who scored the goal? Who scored the goal again?
It was Marquinhos with a header from a corner.
Oh, that one. Yeah, the set piece. There we go. Anyway, deserved goal. And... I'm thinking, as I'm sure you were, maybe City are going to throw it away again. And then half two,
City dominant. Where's Neymar gone? He's gone. One goal, two goal, red card. Some tasty Kool-Aid, wasn't it, Alex? What was going wrong for City in the first half then? And how did they turn it around in the second? Because it really felt like night and day.
Yeah, there was a significant difference. So City in the first half were relatively conservative. They tried to keep the ball. They tried to pass it around in their usual style. But PSG pressed very effectively. The falling back into that 4-4-2 kind of block shape with Verratti busy on the left-hand side, Di Maria on the right-hand side was good at stopping City's ball progression down the flanks. They weren't switching it quickly enough, so they didn't really exploit any space that was there. And PSG hassled and harried and were able to put City on the back foot quite a lot. And because Guardiola had made this decision to be relatively conservative with the deployment of his fullbacks, particularly Kyle Walker on the right-hand side not pushing up that much, which was something that we hinted at in the preview video that we did, on the basis
Don't brag.
I'm not bragging, I'm just flagging it up. That, you know, Kylian Mbappe was going to try and exploit that particular space. It meant that City basically didn't get enough people forwards to be able to maintain the possession structures that they like to do so once they get into the final third. That was exacerbated a little bit as well by the fact that De Bruyne as a false nine was dropping deep as he usually does. But
we were texting about that at that point. Just to focus on the first half for 1 second, because we texted about that during the game. And I remember asking, you know, I wonder, City is so used to dominating, I mean, basically virtually every game that they play. The fullbacks are so integral to it, and their forward movement is integral to it. Without that, it felt a little bit like City's forwards, who are obviously exceptional players, didn't really know, not that they didn't know what to do, but just that they weren't used to playing like that.
Yeah, they felt a lot more isolated than they have done in previous games. And you were getting some forward runs from Gundogan. But because PSG were able to break a lot of those attacks up and were also themselves able to progress the ball through City's press quite well, that meant that City couldn't push people forwards in the same sort of way that they normally do. And that's how those possession structures work. The forwards are supported. You know, when Riyad Mahrez is playing very, very wide on the right-hand side and then cuts inside to create a goal threat from that right-hand side, he's able to do it because the central midfielder is drifting across or the fullback is making the overlap. And without those things happening quite so much because of the way that PSG were pressuring City, it basically meant that Mahrez was kind of thinking, well, do I stay out here as the outball, which is what I'm supposed to do? If I drift inside, there's going to be a cavern of space. There's no one really to support me or give the ball to in quite the same way. And it made everything slightly disjointed. And I think the weird thing about the first half is that City still had more possession. They still had more passes, but there was a bit of a disconnect between the front and the back. And that meant that they weren't able to be as fluid once they had the ball. It was kind of a little bit slower, a little bit more ponderous, and that's why you weren't getting the kind of penetration that you normally do.
It's also the first half, the way that City played robbed us of what I thought would be the most exciting part of the game. And actually Jermaine Genus mentioned this in the commentary on BT2, because in the second half we saw, I think, one glimpse of a foot race between Kyle Walker and Kylian Mbappe. And before the game, I thought that would be something exciting to see. You wouldn't normally see a player, a defender, who might be able to keep pace with him. And because of the way that they played in the first half, we didn't really see that at all. That changed, obviously, as the second half progressed. And I'm left thinking, okay, if the change was that City's fullbacks were allowed to be more attacking and to push a bit further up the pitch, and you know, City completely dominated the second half, was the approach in the first half just over cautiousness? Because clearly when they played the way that they would ordinarily play, they dominated the game.
Yeah, I think it probably was not necessarily over cautiousness, because, you know, they only had a one goal deficit at half time. I think it's understandable when PSG have the kind of threat that they do, particularly from Neymar and Mbappe, but also with Di Maria being a tricky customer who sometimes gets left out of that conversation, and people talk about a front two rather than a front three. But, you know, Di Maria was, there were instances where Mbappe was actually drifting out to the right-hand side and Di Maria was playing centrally. And, you know, there was a lot of movement and rotation going on there. You have to contain that. You have to work your way into a game. I also thought that as the match progressed, Rodri became more influential. You know, he wasn't dealing particularly well with PSG's pressing in the first half. There was one instance, I think, where he gave the ball away that led to a very good chance. But as he was able to assert himself a little bit more as PSG's press fell off, I think that gave City more control and the ability to push forwards a bit more as well. Zinchenko is slightly quicker than Cancelo, so when that change was made, I think, again, that allowed City to push up. So, yeah, it's hard to know, isn't it? I mean, ultimately, they get the result they want to get, so you can make an argument that the conservative first half made sense because they were feeling their way into the game, and then they made the changes that were required and dominated it. If that hadn't happened, then people would obviously look at the first half and go, well, that's where they lost it because they weren't pressing enough, you know.
Mm. Well, I did want to talk about Neymar. Maybe we'll just do that now because it sort of fits in with what we're already discussing. He was outstanding in the first half, and I remember watching him and thinking, you know, this is the player that I'd always imagined that Neymar would be every single game. I haven't watched him for a while. I wonder if, you know, this is what he does week in, week out. In the second half, I think as a result of the way that City changed the way that they were playing, he completely disappeared from the game. I to the point where at times I wondered if he'd been subbed because I didn't spot him on the pitch. You know, it was, I think it's a really extreme example of you know, the game of two halves cliche. But I guess my question then is, you know, one of the reasons that PSG played well in the first half, I think, is because Manchester City didn't play in their ordinary way. As I said, they kept their fullbacks fairly back, fairly narrow, and they essentially couldn't hold onto the ball in the same way. As you described, there was that disjointing between attack and defence, something that City players wouldn't be ordinarily used to. Progressing the ball from defence to attack was difficult for them, and therefore the possession game that they like to play was a little bit different. We know that one of the reasons it's so hard to score against them is because they always have the ball, and because of the way that they played in the first half, that just wasn't true, which is where I think Neymar shone, and, you know, particularly in the middle area of the pitch, those very simple passing interchanges that he was making with Mbappe and Di Maria, he was just outstanding. He was by a million miles the best player on the pitch in the first half. So I guess my question is, the reason I say overcautiousness or potentially overcautiousness is because, as I see it, when City started to play the way that they normally would, Neymar completely disappeared from the game, and presumably that was because the PSG just didn't have the ball.
Yeah, yeah, and it's one of those kind of Guardiola maxims that, you know, if you've got the ball, the opposition can't attack. You know, possession is a form of defence as well as being the way that you create attacks, and I think that it wasn't just that City had the ball. It was also the way that PSG were winning the ball back in the first half.
Right.
Through that midfield pressing, through creating that kind of narrow band of four in the middle that would then spring forwards. And, you know, Verratti was able to kind of roam around and link play. Paredes is very good at playing the ball from deep. So when PSG won the ball in the first half, there was usually quite a bit of space for Neymar to start to be able to move into. Mbappe is doing likewise, Di Maria is doing likewise, and all of a sudden City are facing three extremely quick, talented attackers who keep swapping positions in a way that's really quite irritating if you're a defender.
Yeah.
And PSG were able to create those transitions, which is exactly the circumstance in which Neymar thrives. He wants to have the ball at his feet, with defenders having to make decisions, with space to run into, and with players moving around him. So it wasn't just that in the second half City had the ball a lot more. It was also that PSG were not winning the ball back in the same way to then create those opportunities to transition. And Neymar sometimes he does forage and drop deeper and try and win the ball back closer to his own kind of midfield area, but that wasn't the game plan here. You know, the opportunity, and weirdly in the second half, that opportunity almost would have been more present if PSG had been able to win the ball back, because City were playing
yeah,
higher and with their fullbacks pushed up. So it made sense for Neymar to stay where he was and wait for those opportunities to come. It's just in the second half they didn't.
Do you know what he reminded me of in that game? Have you seen The Sopranos?
Yeah, of course.
I'm watching The Sopranos now. As people, listeners probably know, my only cultural references come from whatever's happening in my life at that moment. I can't remember anything else. But the Sopranos, what a great show. Do you remember when Tony meets Gloria, one of his gourmands, as they call them in the show? He meets her in his therapist's office, and she works at the Mercedes dealership.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, Gloria. Yeah. Gloria is amazing at the beginning, isn't she, to Tony? Tony thinks she's the coolest. She's a fun, cultural, sexy woman. Yeah? And that's great for Tony. And then in the second half, Neymar throws a stake at his head. And it'll, you know,
it all goes
and
to
wants,
shit.
Wants Tony to kill him. And that's what I was left with visions of. Neymar as Gloria from The Sopranos.
Yeah.
You know, it's an up-and-down relationship.
The most involved Neymar seemed to get in the second half, from memory, was that vociferous protesting to try and get one of City's players sent off.
Which I hate so much. I know it's a bit of like a normal thing to get upset about that sort of stuff. And that is something which is attached to Neymar, right, as part of his perceived personality. But you can hear them shouting, it's the same, it's the same. I think it was Marquinhos who was shouting, it's the same, it's the same. It's not the same.
It was not even close to being the same. No, and it's weird. And that's the two sides of Neymar. You have an extraordinarily talented footballer who, like you say, you know, was the best player on the pitch of a pitch full of really, really good players in the first half.
Yeah.
And then as he becomes peripheral, he becomes petulant and irritable and whingy, and it's just a shame, because I think, you know, City are obviously now in a really pretty dominant position, taking this back to the Etihad, and it may be that once again Neymar is going to fall short, or before even reaching the final hurdle as he did previously. But
it's funny, we've got a video coming out on him soon. Have you seen, actually separate this one, I'm not sure if you've seen the script, Alex, but I won't give away the game, but within it we talk about the number of goals that Neymar has scored, you know, per season throughout his career, and I think only twice has he scored more than 20. And, you know, generally speaking, the reason for that in the vast majority of seasons is because of his pretty bad injury record.
Yeah,
it's a shame, really. I mean, like, you know, you would have hoped when we saw him at the 2014 World Cup, I suppose, was 7 years ago now in Brazil. And, you know, the iconic memory of that Brazil team for me, aside from the 7-1, is, you know, Neymar, this young guy supposedly carrying this whole country on his back, and then his back goes. Do you know, like, he's even injured out of the World Cup on his home territory. It just seems like something that's happened to him over and over and over again, and
he
enormously impacted his career.
Oh, hugely. But he gets fouled so much, you know, because of the way he plays. And yes, when he gets fouled, he then does like 15 rolls and his face is the grimace of pain like you've never seen. But he does get kicked constantly by players who are not as good as he is. And I think there is probably for him, on a more existential level, that frustration of knowing how good he is, knowing that the only way people are going to be able to stop him is by kicking him, that then has injuries attached to it, that he misses out on certain things. I think that probably goes to why he plays the way he does sometimes. Because on his day, he's just extraordinarily fun to watch.
Absolutely. Well, anyway, screw him. Let's talk about De Bruyne. Fairly quiet in the first half, but he also, a bit like you were talking about with Rodri, started to impose himself more and more as the game went on. Is he the best player left in the tournament, do you think?
I think he's the best all-round player left in the tournament, because I think what De Bruyne does is he's the complete midfielder. There's nothing he can't do. And that involves even the defensive work rate, the tackling. He's surprisingly physical, something that we've talked about before. Sam Lee did his sort of on the whistle piece, which I read
this
morning.
Athletic.
Of The Athletic. And it was talking about how De Bruyne's cheeks were still red when he was being interviewed. And in a funny sort of way, like, if it were any other footballer, I'd have just sort of passed over that comment. But with De Bruyne, it kind of conjures up this image of, there's something almost like very young about him still, that he's fresh faced and kind of huffs and puffs.
It's the skin tone, I would say, with the hair colour, probably.
I think it probably is. But so he's, you know, he's got that dynamism to his game.
I've got a young face.
Right. I got told by a woman in a petrol station when I was buying cigarettes wearing a mask that I had young eyes.
Did she ID you?
I think she was thinking about it. Oh, no, maybe she did ID me. Yeah.
I hope she did, because if she said you had young eyes, that feels like you didn't pass the 25 test, you know?
Which is bizarre, because we both know that I'm considerably older than that.
That's true. Most of your skin wrinkles would have been beneath the mask, though, so I guess she's forgiven.
Yeah, and also the beard. So really, if there's, you know, I've got a small patch where the wrinkles might show.
Yeah.
Yeah, masks have been good for vanity.
I like them. I don't want to. I mean, it's a bit warm now, so it's not as much fun. But over the last few months, going for walks and such in the English weather, I've just worn them when I'm nowhere near anyone because my face is warm, you know. Mm. And I wonder if that's what De Bruyne was doing just before he got to... Maybe that's why his cheeks were all rosy. It is possible.
So yes, in answer to your question, I would say he is the best all-round player left.
Forgot what my question was. Let's talk about Riyad Mahrez as well, because he was the surprise taker of the free kick for City's second goal, which was a nice free kick. That bad wall, though. Bad wall.
Bad wall, yeah.
Really bad. But he's been brilliant recently, I've noticed. And I feel also, like, you know, stacked among City's talent as he is, he's sometimes a bit overlooked, you know, because he came from Leicester and it's a little bit less flashy and whatever. But he's been, you know, fairly consistently good over the last couple of years. A couple of dips in form.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. The interesting thing about Mahrez is that he's a flashy player, right? You know, he's got tricks and he's got changes of pace and he can drive inwards and shoot and do all of this cool stuff. But in the City Guardiola setup, he actually plays in quite a disciplined way.
He's extremely important.
Which is extremely important because he's there to provide that initial width. Guardiola is a big fan of having his wide players staying wide. That then allows, you know, whether the fullback continues the underlap or whether it's a midfielder, but the idea of stretching out the opposition defence by maintaining that width, I think what it sometimes means is that the more, and that particularly happens on the right-hand side, because Foden seems to have a lot more license to drift in from the left-hand side. And so Mahrez is following orders that, in a way, limit him as a player. But the fact that he's able to do that, the fact that he's able to maximise his input when he does get the ball and still do important things, and also work really hard. You know, he was getting back and defending. Like, he's not a natural defender, but he was making, you know, he was covering a lot of ground on that right flank, particularly in the first half when Walker was as deep as he was. Just goes to show, I think, that there is a collective ethic in that Manchester City team, and it means that we'll probably not see the sort of Mahrez that we could have seen had he gone to a club that required his individual creativity more. And that's sort of a shame.
Well, we saw that at Leicester, though, didn't we?
We saw that at Leicester. What I mean is, if he went to Arsenal, where they kind of went, oh, let's just please give it to him and see what he can do, then we'd have got more of a bag of tricks and more goals and more assists. But what instead is somebody who does exactly what they are supposed to do to extremely high technical level. And that's kind of what City want from all of their players.
I feel like Arsenal are exactly the sort of club to buy a 31-year-old Riyad Mahrez. So,
yes.
And then, like, expect the world.
Sign him on a free when he's, like, 32 way more money than they should do, at the expense of a much talented younger winger who's waiting to come through.
Do you know what I get annoyed at? Is how annoyed Arsenal fans, not all of them obviously, but some Arsenal fans get with Willian. I think you knew what you were signing, surely. It's Willian. Well, he hasn't done anything amazing for 4 years. It's like, it's, you know, He's a good winger who puts in a hard work and a good shift. But when was the last time he scored more than 5 goals in a season? A long time ago.
Yeah.
Long
time ago. Yeah. I mean, Willian, you know you're going to get a decent amount of pressing and the occasional good ball delivery from a set piece.
Sure.
That's what Willian is now, really. Has been for a while. Anyway.
Good Willian.
Not to get into Arsenal.
Riyad Mahrez scored that goal, didn't he? The goal, of course, scored against Keylor Navas, Tifo's favourite goalkeeper. I've only one thing to say about Keylor Navas, Tifo's favourite goalkeeper, and that is that with his blonde hair, he looks a bit like that character from all those films. You know the one, Alex, who the undercover adult police officer with who's sort of undercover with the college kids at spring break or something. And it's really patently obvious that he is quite a lot older than everybody else. That he's,
what's that? Is it 21 Jump Street?
That's an example of one of those films, sure. Yeah,
is it a whole genre?
It's a whole genre, yeah. Right, you're okay. Undercover with the kids. But, you know, there's a series awful. Of films. I'm trying to remember some names. I can't. From the 80s and 90s where it's absolutely obvious that this person is 20 years older and is, you know,
the irony being that also all of the people that are playing college kids are also in like at least 25.
Yeah, it's
kind
of weird.
The whole thing is just shifted up.
To come back to The Sopranos, right? Did you... Megan and I have been like laughing so much about this in every episode because Carmela and Tony in season one are supposed to be 38 and 37.
No.
And then I thought that was
really?
Absurd, right? I looked at how old James Gandolfini was when he was filming that. He yeah. was 37 when he started filming The Sopranos. He Jeez. Looks like a 60-year-old man. He's 30. He's your age. Tony Soprano
younger,
is your
younger
age.
Younger than me.
I'm not sure if it's just something that happens to you where you don't notice what you look like to other people, but Tony Soprano being younger than 40, absurd to me. Absurd.
But have you watched it all the way through before?
Yes.
So I wonder whether part of it is that...
The immense amount of stress and pressure.
Well, yes, but also the Tony Soprano that we have in our mind is the Tony Soprano at the end when all of the bad stuff has happened and he's also in real life, whatever, 8-10 years old or something.
Sure.
And so it's quite difficult to go all the way back to the first episode.
It's not when you're watching it, though. I mean, I'm looking at him in front
still
of
a
me
surprise.
On telly.
Right.
He doesn't look any different at the end than he does at the beginning. I think he just came out of the womb looking like a 48-year-old
slightly
man.
Haggard, yeah. And, yeah.
It's crazy.
Not
anyway,
haggard,
so these cultural
the
references are... Haggard is the wrong word. These references are about 25 years out of date, aren't they? So we'll stop doing them now. But do watch The Sopranos. It's fantastic. Hey, let's... back to the football. It's not over, is it? Because presumably, as I believe the BT commentary pointed out, Pochettino's going to watch this game back. And he'll be looking for things to change. What will those things be, do you think? Because PSG had a pretty good grip on the first half, as discussed. Almost no grip at all on the second half. We assume we know how Pep's going to approach the second leg as a result of the first. But what will Pochettino be looking to do?
I think it's hard for him because PSG are most effective when they're breaking at pace. And... it's not going to be... I mean, even against the lesser teams in Ligue 1, that is still the predominant... Like, they can play through the lines, obviously. They've got really good midfielders. But the main threat is still Mbappe or Neymar getting in behind.
Yeah.
And City are going to be an even more extreme version of what they were like in the second half at home because they're going to have the confidence of... a one-goal cushion, but those goals being away goals, they're going to look to dominate and push forwards. And so it's going to be a very kind of tight balancing act for PSG that they're going to want to leave those two guys up in the 4-4-2 block that they have. You know, there'll be a big old gap between Mbappe and Neymar and everyone else, but those chances will be few and far between. So what they have to really do is play... kind of how they did in the first half, but knowing that City are going to play more like they did in the second half and be super clinical. Because they will get a chance or two, Yeah. And set pieces, you know, Marquinhos did well from that corner. That is still going to be a threat. Di Maria is a brilliant, brilliant set piece taker.
Yeah. There's a couple of other exceptional corners, weren't there?
Yeah. He's got, I mean, he's as good as De Bruyne with the ball in actual play. You know, De Bruyne gets that kind of whip and dip and curl on the ball, and Di Maria can do the same thing from a set piece. So they will have the opportunity. I don't think... It's not going to be one of those games where Pochettino goes and sits down and watches it and thinks, ah, shit, if we'd done X, Y, and Z, we would have won this.
Yeah.
There's not going to be a clear answer. It's going to be doing a lot of the things that they were already always going to do, but just doing them a little bit better, which is a kind of boring answer, I'm sorry. But
No, I think, you know, it's probably a good answer. It was a bit boring, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, that's, you're here to bring the fun.
Oh, sorry, okay. Final question on this game. Having seen both first legs, Alex, I'm trying to bring some fun, do we still think that the winner of this tie is likely to be the winner of the competition? Not both legs, sorry, both first legs.
Sure, yes, I got that.
You got it.
Before the games... I would have
He's
said
He's not
yes,
so sure anymore.
But having seen Chelsea, I know I'm not so sure anymore. I mean, I still think that you, particularly on the back of the whole season, you still fancy Manchester City to win any game they go into against anybody. I don't think that's unreasonable. But there is something about the way Chelsea play that just makes me think... If there's anyone who could upset City, then it's going to be them. I think that's the most likely final at this point. And Tuchel's game plan for that would be not dissimilar to what PSG would try and do as well. You know, using pace to attack particular channels, dragging defenders out of position. That, like, it makes sense. The reason that City would be vulnerable to Chelsea is the same reason that they'll be vulnerable to PSG. So yeah, you can see that happening.
Okay. Well, anyway, that's the end of that bit. We'll come back after this with another bit.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Okay, it's the second bit now. Real Madrid 1-1 Chelsea. Bit of an odd game, Alex. A reminder, if it was at all necessary, that this was the first time Chelsea and Real Madrid have ever met in the Champions League. And boy, was it a wet one because of the rain. Delightful goal from Benzema to tie it up at 1-1 after Pulisic scored an early goal in the first half. Fairly balanced at times, I think. But overall, it seemed to me that Chelsea controlled the game a bit better. And I wasn't expecting that beforehand, Alex, to be quite honest with you.
Why not?
Because I'm not good at football.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, I suppose, yes. I mean, obviously, Real are at home. They've got lots of good players. They've got strong midfielders who keep the ball well and pass it around. But this sort of weird system that Zidane employed, which I guess on paper was probably a 3-5-2. I mean, I think Benzema and Vinicius were sort of like a striking pair, but Vinicius was almost exclusively drifting out to the left-hand side. You had all of these weird movements going on of players pushing up and tucking in, Toni Kroos dropping back to almost be like a left-sided centre-back in a back four that was comprised of other centre-backs. Like, I could...
It was
weird. I could see what was happening, but there was no part of me that went, oh, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think Kroos dropping back made sense in that Chelsea are very, very good at pressing in midfield areas and trying to create a bit of space for Kroos to be able to pass the ball long. Michael Cox wrote that article about what they did in their last Champions League game. The idea of getting kind of Kroos in the pocket to play these long balls into the channels that could then be chased and attacked.
Little pocket
and he was
Kroos.
Having to do that. Sorry?
Little pocket Kroos.
Yeah, little pocket Kroos. There was, you know, there was a requirement to do that deeper against Chelsea because their midfield press and the blocking is so effective. So there were bits of it that made you think, yeah, okay, I can understand why this is happening. But it created these very odd shapes with people popping up in positions that just didn't seem to be effective. Whereas Chelsea were very much more what you'd expect them to be. There were some clever little tweaks. So when they were blocking, they were using a kind of 3-3-2-2, which is something that Dermot Corrigan picked up on Twitter. Yeah. And that kind of box shape of pressing at the beginning, not at the beginning, at the upper end of the pitch, allowed them to kind of flex around and stop the ball progression and reduce Casemiro's ability to move the ball through the deep areas. That was really smart. The way the fullbacks were sort of controlling the movement of the opposition players by not always going as high to start with and then bursting forwards into the space behind. Like, you know, Tuchel is very good at making these subtle tactical adaptations on a game-by-game basis, but within a structure that remains very consistent. But then it's always Real Madrid, isn't it? You always just have that feeling that because they've got certain players and because they've got Zidane in the dugout and blah, 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 they can do stuff that is going to put the tie on its head. So like it, I don't know. It kind of made sense, but I guess in a way you're right.
Okay, a word on Jorginho, who seems to have thrown off the criticism of yesteryear already under Tuchel in what's only probably about 20 games, Alex.
Yeah, I mean, I think okay. So Jorginho obviously was massively associated with Maurizio Sarri because he brought him in, because he was Sarri's key man at Napoli.
He was Sarri boy.
He was Sarri boy of Sarri ball. And it just went badly, didn't it, for pretty much everyone concerned.
I felt bad for him. I'm glad he's doing well.
Yeah, and then again under Lampard, I think, because Lampard had this incredibly kind of loose midfield structure and wanted to attack in a certain kind of way, again, Jorginho just looked a little bit lost. Whereas here, it feels like... that. So Tuchel likes to have this midfielder who drops off and creates a diamond with the back three and who can then spray the ball around. That is an ideal situation for Jorginho because that's what he's good at doing. He also then dovetails really well with whoever his midfield partner is, whether it's Kante or Kovacic, to create that kind of quite narrow little screening band that moves backwards and forwards, protects the back three. And it feels like, I don't think Tuchel has designed a system to get the best out of Jorginho. I think the way that Tuchel wants to play happens to benefit a player who's already there. And his influence is really growing. And what it also allowed... So, you know, Kante's movement was, I thought, very, very good against Real Madrid. A lot of the time that Kante was either pushing up or drifting back, it was creating spaces for other players. And occasionally Kante himself was able to burst into space.
Yeah.
And because Jorginho is sitting in front of that back three, and as a unit they can move forwards, they can control the tempo, that means that whoever is playing alongside him in midfield has more latitude to move around and create space for other people and push into space themselves. So I think Kante was a beneficiary of that against Real Madrid. Kovacic has been a beneficiary of it otherwise. But Jorginho is really making a lot of what Chelsea do tick. And
it's quite funny, isn't it, really?
Because it's great.
These midfielders, these central midfielders have been the huge problem for almost as long as I can remember. I mean, obviously, you know, back to Sarri joining. and the times between then and now. But Tuchel's making it look like extraordinarily easy. Tuchel's making, you know, he's coming in, he's almost just gone, yeah, what everyone thought, do that, and it works.
It's really odd, isn't it? Because the overriding impression of Chelsea this season is that Tuchel makes it look easy. Yeah. that there's not been this. I mean, yes, okay, he's using a slightly different system to. I mean, Lampard experimented with a back three as well, but he's just come in and gone, right, do this, guys, and they've all gone, yeah, okay, yeah, we'll do that. And it's
I think, like, of course, away. Kante and Jorginho is an incredible midfield partner. Of course it is. Whereas before, I don't know. It's funny anyway.
I suppose part of it is also that the structures that you build around a midfield are so important, and Mason Mount does, you know, in Mason Mount and Kante, they've got two players who both do the work of one and a half to two people. In the fact that Rudiger has come back into form, Christensen is being used well, you know, you've got defenders who can control the ball or bring the ball forwards. It's just that, you know, he's created a system and it really suits one of the midfielders. Everybody's playing better or in a role that is good for everybody else. But the fact that he's managed to do this as quickly and seemingly effortlessly as he has is a kind of real, like, wow, that's just very impressive.
If there was a sort of question mark at all against Chelsea's performances recently, and a bit on the night perhaps, it might have been about Timo Werner. I mean, lots of people pointed out that his off-the-ball runs were actually really good in this game. It's just when he's in front of goal, isn't it? It's a little... But anyway, Liam Toomey recently wrote an Athletic article, I think it might be out today, with some of these interesting key stats. I thought I'd read them to you, Alex, and you can react to them in real time, okay?
Okay.
Stat number one. Werner is one of 11 Premier League forwards to have played more than 1,000 minutes and had at least 20 of what Opta terms big chances.
Yeah.
Yep, okay, that's not the reaction I was hoping for, but I'll carry on. EPL big chance conversion, for Werner, is 22.7%. Kane is 60, Salah is 46.4, Bamford around 25%. How do you react to that?
Shock.
A noise or...
Disgust.
Yeah, okay, you've said the word of an emotion there, that's fine.
Horrendous.
Had a big chance conversion of 67% in his debut season, 46% last season. Big chances are, of course, harder to come by for him in this league as compared to the Bundesliga. Apparently it's 0.88, I assume, per match that is here, versus 1.14 and 1.25 in his last two Bundesliga seasons. He needs to find his clinical touch, doesn't he?
He does.
I'm going to say I was disappointed by your reactions. I just want to try that one more time. Well, I just want a little bit more from you. Just step out on the plank a little bit, as they did in the old pirate times. Just take a risk, okay? One more time. Here we go. His big chance conversion rate is 22.7%. Kane's is 60.
Wow, 60. That's almost three times as much.
That's good. You're staggered. Okay, now you can answer the question.
Okay, thank you. Part of this is to do with what a big chance is. And
what is a big chance?
It's a chance where
it's big.
It's a contested kind of designation. It's basically the chance. It's a chance where you should score. Is the simplest way of putting it, by which people would generally understand that you've got a greater chance of scoring than not.
So he's basically only scoring one in five of those.
Yeah, it's basically the sort of thing where he's put through on goal, or where it comes to him maybe no more than 8 yards out and there aren't many defenders around. It's that sort of chance. It's the chance that makes you think, oh, why didn't he score that when he didn't score it?
It's the chance that Kane scores 60% of the time.
Yes, exactly. Which, you know, Kane is very, very good. I think with with the way that Leipzig played in the Bundesliga, he was going to get more of those because he was the guy that was running through against a higher defence. It was him one-on-one with the goalkeeper. He would still, you know, screw them up every so often. I think the issue is here that he's expected to be more of a kind of sole focal point. And he is... Yes, his runs are good when Chelsea are attacking at pace. What I don't see him doing... that I'd like to see him do a bit more is his movement when Chelsea are building more slowly and have got control of the ball around the final third. Yeah. He seems to be a little bit static sometimes. He seems to, you know, Chelsea needs to be going full throttle for his movement to make sense. And it's really difficult because, you know, you've got in Tammy Abraham a very, very good young striker on the bench, but a striker of a completely different profile.
Who they're entirely committed to selling by the sounds of it.
Which does and doesn't make sense to me. I mean, it doesn't make sense because Tammy Abraham is a naturally good player and you would think, I'd quite like to hold on to that. But at the same time, he's so different from the type of striker that looks to be what is appropriate for Tuchel's system that it kind of like, yeah. I don't know.
Well, it's kind of the Lukaku Man United thing a bit, isn't it? Like, Lukaku is clearly the best striker that United had. He just didn't fit in the system that they wanted to play.
Yeah, and he goes somewhere else where the system is more suitable for him and he absolutely kills it. So, you know,
a separate question, though. Like, the reports or the rumours suggest that Tammy Abraham is available for sale, for purchase, I should say, for £40 million. That's where the club would start listening to offers. Who's going to buy him for £40 million, though?
I don't think anyone's going to buy him for £40 million, sadly.
No.
Partly because I don't think that many clubs have got £40 million.
Would someone buy him for £30 million?
Yeah, I think that's more likely. I think there's a sort of... £30 million is kind of like your superstar buy if you're a small club who doesn't have, you know,
that's what I mean, though. He's still a bit unproven. Is he a superstar for a club of, you know, bottom half of the league?
I don't think he's unproven. I still think that a sensible sort of thing is to loan him to somewhere like Dortmund for a season if Haaland goes and see what he can do in a slightly
different... See his price rocket.
Well, I think you'd see his price go up for sure, but I think you'd also get used to him. He's not going to be able to play as Chelsea's central striker unless Chelsea commit to him and teach him how to play in that sort of system. Because he's not just like a kind of slow, lanky target man kind of player.
No.
Like he can adapt, but he's not going to adapt.
The boy has skills.
A good run of games in that position. So getting him to play somewhere that will start him regularly in a system that is a kind of an adaptation towards what would be expected of him at Chelsea, I think is a much better idea than just going in this depressed market this summer. Yeah. Oh yeah, let's just ship him out and see if we can. You're not going to get £40 million for him. You'll end up selling him for 25, and people will then look back at the fact that he then goes and scores 15 or 20 goals for whoever he plays for and go, Chelsea were robbed.
Well,
perhaps.
Moving on.
But wow, Harry Kane's chance conversion rate.
Oh, there we go. I like that. Chelsea also apparently... Well, actually, I only checked this for a bit way through the second half, but Chelsea also ran about 5% more than Real Madrid, apparently. Young legs, etc. I was going to ask you about it, but also, Manny, I just wanted to say this because it made me think of that Christina Aguilera song. Do you know the one I mean?
No. Sing it.
You know the one that goes, makes me that much stronger.
Absolutely. Yes.
Thanks for making me a fighter. And then I basically
is it Red
I just started
Man?
Reading the lyrics to this
is
song.
Is he in it? The videos no, the video, there's a rap element to it, isn't it? And the video's in a ring. I'm pretty sure
I don't remember.
True.
I actually got confused at the beginning and I Google searched Survivor by...
That's Destiny's Child.
Destiny's Child, because yeah. I thought it was the same song. No, it's not the same song. It's just two songs about being a survivor. Anyway, sure. I read the lyrics to this song. I like to read the lyrics to pop songs. Sometimes it's extremely funny. And in this case, it was kind of funny. And I thought I'd read this verse to you, Alex, because it's extremely aggressive.
Right, okay.
I hadn't realised, listening, that this song is really an aggressive song. But you have to read it in an aggressive way. So I'm going to do that. Excuse me, here we go. Never saw it coming. That's the first line, yeah? All of your backstabbing, just so you could cash in on a good thing. Before I realised your game... I heard you're going round playing the victim now, But don't even begin to feel I'm the one to blame, because you've dug your own grave.
Oh.
That's from Christina Aguilera's song.
That took an unexpected twist at the end, didn't it?
Yeah, you've dug your own grave. Just all of your backstabbing.
Yeah, there's... I didn't know Christina was capable of that kind of aggression.
Don't think she wrote it, but go and read the lyrics. Basically, to any pop song, it's always fun, but that one particularly, because it's, you know, I know it's a powerful song, isn't it? It's an emotional song, and presumably it's about a breakup or something, I don't know, some kind of pain, but I had no idea the message that was going into my brain as a child was so one of such violence.
Yeah, it explains a lot, though.
Can Real Madrid turn it around?
I'm going to say no.
All right, then. Well, that was the end of this bit, and we'll be back after this to do Joe's Player Quotes and Facts database.
It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year.
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations. Forgotten. The history.
Vegas Golden Knights.
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's Joe's Quotes and Facts Database. Aha, it's Joe's Player Quotes and Facts Database. Yes, it's been we've had a brief sojourn, haven't we? But we're back now. And I remembered why we had a break, because last night at 10:30 p.m., when it took me an extra 45 minutes to find these nothing things, it all came flooding back as to why I really, really don't want to keep doing this. But I have done. And I've picked two Chelsea players, for obvious reasons. Today, we've got Timo Werner and Kai Havertz. Timo Werner and Kai Havertz. Which one would you like to start with, Alex?
I'll start with Kai Havertz, please.
Let's do Kai Havertz first, okay. The less funny of the two. Kai Havertz is a forward, And I did him second, and you can really see that I wanted to go to bed, okay? His father was a police officer, and his mother was a lawyer. Yeah, the perfect family for a life of crime. Also, his brother is called Jan, and his sister is called Leah. And didn't his parents pick cool names? Don't they sound cool? Jan, Leah, and Kai Havertz. That sounds like a cool family, doesn't it?
Yeah, I wonder if they came in alphabetical order.
Maybe they did. He's the youngest, so they didn't.
No. Oh, well.
I didn't need to wonder, did I? Here's the quote from Kai Havertz. I believe he told this to Bundesliga.com. Bundesliga.com. He said, "At 14 or 15, I was still one of the smallest players in the team," which is hard to imagine, isn't it? And then he didn't say that bit. And then he said, "Then I went through a pretty dramatic growth spurt. I had to get used to my legs being longer. It affects the whole way you play football." Apparently, he grew really quick because he's extremely tall now. And I have thought before, he's unusually tall for a playmaker or a player of his sort of ability. And I guess that's because, up until the age of 15, he was one of the smallest players on the team. That is a late
growth.
That's spurt. Really interesting because he is. He's taller and he's a lot quicker than the sort of player he is normally is. So I wonder if he developed certain technical skills because he never, because he was small, like the kind of the Andreas Iniesta argument that if you're not strong enough to keep the ball, you have to become really technically proficient. And then he also turned into this incredibly rapid monster. Yeah. So he's got,
I guess, everything. Having to, like, your whole, center of gravity changes, doesn't it?
Yeah, completely. Yeah.
So, you know, well done to Kai.
Interesting.
Okay, Timo Werner now, also a forward, of course. Here's a fact from lifebogger.com, my favourite website. It's Lifebogger. I do love it. Mm. And this is, of course, according to lifebogger.com. Quote from their childhood story of Timo Werner. The quote begins, "Growing up, Timo's parents taught him four ideal moral values." Now, four is important there, Alex, and you'll understand at the end why I've said that, okay? One, respect for all. That's reasonable, isn't it? That's a good moral to have. Two, being generous / helpful. So I guess just one of those. But then, you know, they're interchangeable in a way, aren't they? It's okay. Is there a scenario in which you can be both generous and helpful? I guess there is. I don't know. Yeah.
I think by being helpful, you're automatically being generous, at least with your time, aren't you? So,
I guess so.
It makes sense.
I'm trying to think of a way of disproving what you've said, but I'm just going to move on to number three. Having a sense of responsibility. That's a very important thing, I'd say. good. Four. Remember, four. Never hurting anyone. Also, that's a good... You know, it's not probably that possible to go through your life without hurting people. We are going to hurt people. Just by nature of relationships existing, huh? People are going to get hurt. Alex, you've been hurt, haven't you?
Yes.
Yes, it explains a lot. And five. Now, do you remember why I said to remember four? Five.
Yes.
Formulating the habit of sharing. That's five.
That is five.
It wasn't four, it was five. But, I mean, they're all good, strong messages. And formulating the habit of sharing,
even six, actually.
Potentially even because, six, if you were to separate generous and helpful, as discussed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And Timo Werner's quote,
how confusing.
"Who wants a piece of this delicious cake?" That's the quote there.
Right.
So that's it. That's,
why do Lifebogger's facts often have this kind of slightly...
I don't know,
COD philosophy therapy angle to them, don't they?
They always also have, and I've never used a bit from these parts because it feels like wading into, you know, the same reason we haven't mentioned the other funny thing that happened at Chelsea this week. So it always feels like wading into a bit more of a soap opera area. But for every player history, they do a few things. At the beginning, they say, everyone knows that Kai Havertz is, you know, a technically supreme player. But what they don't know, they might not know some facts of his biography. And then every article starts with that sentence, but with, you know, the name changed. And also, they almost always have a section about their girlfriend or wife. And again, it always starts with this cliche. There's an old adage that says, behind every good man is a good woman. And no different for Timo Werner. There's like pictures of his wife or his girlfriend. And all sorts of, you know, I nearly picked a quote from this this one, because I believe Timo Werner's girlfriend was described as extremely selfless because she doesn't work and she just dedicates her life to Timo Werner. And it has a very unusual, overtone to it.
Yeah.
So I don't do those bits.
No,
but Lifebogger, you know, it's good. It's a good laugh to go there. And I hope people to stop using them at some point. It feels that, you know, this podcast just becoming a Lifebogger podcast. But do check them out. Mm-hmm. Really do.
Yeah. I'll be sure to.
Anyway, that's pretty much the end of the podcast now. Except for one thing. A little for our little outro here, I wanted to stop talking while the big car goes past, but I haven't stopped, so I've carried on. We were sent a nice thing, weren't we, Alex, on Twitter actually, I don't know who sent it to us. Thanks for who sent it to us.
By
person. But it was this thing written in Sport Bible by a guy called Jack Kenmare.
And we were sent a little screenshot of part of it. The story is about, and I'll read now, Daniel Gamboa, born and raised in the Los Angeles suburb of La Crescenta. La Crescenta. I'm sure they say it like that, don't they? La Crescenta. Suppressed his inner tactician by submitting 347 words on how the popular game A Football Manager inspired him to study global affairs. And he was accepted at the University of California after he wrote this application essay. What's this got to do with me, are you thinking? Well now, let me just find the bit that is. Because, oh yes, Daniel was quoted as saying, it's a niche interest here in the States, and my faithful viewership of... Yep, you got it. TIFO football meant that I could connect the game to global politics and diplomacy, explains Daniel. And he was accepted at the University of California, Alex. Isn't that nice?
It's lovely.
Congratulations, Daniel Gamboa. And it's also got me thinking, you know, not many people get articles written about them, do they? So if this is a kind of, this is a one, how many people do you think that's happened to? This very specific set of circumstances, because they've, you know, normally it's like 1,000 people, isn't it? If there's one, if one person has been written
sure.
about. So basically what that means is that it's likely that many thousands of people have been inspired and helped by us, isn't it? That's basically what this means, is that it's actually...
Probably fewer people will have gained entry to university by writing about Football Manager having also watched TIFO. I think
maybe.
Got a
maybe
slightly but, smaller
but basically
there.
The point to focus on though is that we are extremely influential and people we're extremely popular and we're really great. That's the main thing I've taken away from this.
I might have gone with the more of a kind of Timo Werner slant here and talk about being helpful and
right
you know allowing people to access things they wouldn't otherwise, but you've just gone for great.
Well, I just, you know, what I'm saying is that, you know, Daniel Gamboa's success story is basically my success story. That's what I'm saying. Obviously, he's got into university and I'm very pleased for him to have been accepted, but it's a bit like I've been accepted at Berkeley or University of California, whichever one it is. Yeah. It's a bit basically like I've been accepted, isn't it?
It is a bit like that. Yes.
And Daniel Gamboa, you're welcome. And University of California, I shall be sending you, I don't know, something, an invoice? I don't know what for. But there we go. Congratulations to Daniel Gamboa. Wishing you all the best on your journey through collegehood. Yeah? I'm sure it'll be fine.
Probably just watches the videos. He doesn't listen to the podcast.
This wasn't about Daniel Gamboa, Alex. This was about me. It doesn't matter if he's listening. I don't care if he's listening. I don't actually care about Daniel Gamboa. I just want people to know that I've been accepted to the University of California.
I care about Daniel Gamboa.
Yeah.
I do. Hi, Daniel.
Well, that's all for today. Thanks for listening. Thanks for downloading. Seb will be back next week and Alex will be away. But we will be introducing a new character, a new face to the complexion here of TIFO football. And it's rather exciting, isn't it? So you'll be able to hear from a new TIFO staff member as of the next podcast that we release. So look forward to that. Alex, thanking you.
Thank you, Joe.
I forgot to sort of do an impression of what Seb would have said on this episode, but maybe we'll save that for another time, because I've also remembered that, of course, producer Adonis has gone off to have a baby, like a turncoat traitor that he is, leaving us here alone. Well, not alone, because we've got producer Ollie for the next few weeks who's listening in now. He was 3 minutes late, I'm not going to lie. It was very difficult for me to accept, and I'm hoping that producer Ollie, we can rectify that over the course of the next few weeks. We shall see. I'll be asking you what it was that, you know, made you think you were qualified for this role. But we'll find out in private, and I'm sure it'll all be fine. But thanks to producer Ollie and Thomas Hughes for today as well. And we'll be back next Tuesday. So until then, au revoir, TIFOs. Thank you.
The Athletic.